feel that he was looking for. And so one day he's sitting in his uncle's office, and he was staring at this sort of exotic novelty clock that came from the faraway land of Scotland, probably brought over by missionaries. And as he was staring at it, it chimed, and he had found the melody, the right tune for their country's national anthem. And so he had his new song, and the national anthem was played, and it was accepted as the new national anthem. But what they didn't know, this was a very old song that most of us associate with rowdy New Year's Eve parties. It was Auld Lang Syne. And so for a number of years, for many years, the Maldives had a national anthem to the tune of Auld Lang Syne. And I believe I think South Korea did as well. It was a popular tune for national anthems, apparently. But in the 1970s, the country got word that the Queen of England was coming to visit them. And a lot had changed in those years. And so eager to impress Elizabeth, they kind of did checking over, like when you've got important company over, you're like, okay, the couch is there, the everything. And they, our national anthem is not very cool. We need a new tune. And so yet again, the country was in this position of needing a new song for a new era. Psalm 98 in the Bible is about needing a new song for a new era. Sometimes we need new songs. And when I say that, I'm speaking metaphorically. So for those of you who took that very literally, I don't mean we need a new theme song for walking around, although that would be awesome, and sometimes I have one in my head. You know, for that sunny day, you're like, I've got my song. But I'm not talking about that. But we need a new vision. A new way of looking at life, a new way of imagining our own futures, a new way of seeing God. We need new songs when our old ways of being or believing have failed us or just aren't working anymore, when our world has been shaken in some way or our beliefs that we've always held on to are no longer providing helpful answers to our questions. We need new songs when God has surprised us by not acting in the way that we expected he would, but acting nonetheless in unexpected ways, in new ways, when our categories have been stretched or redefined. We're in the sixth Sunday of Easter. So Easter is not over yet. In the liturgical calendar, it keeps going for a little while. And we're in the sixth Sunday, which means we're following along the story that happens after the resurrection. So we're following along as though we are one of the disciples, imagining what it would have been like in those weeks following Jesus' resurrection from the dead. And let me tell you, those disciples were in a place of needing a new song. Their world, their faith, their lives had been turned upside down in the last few weeks. Jesus was not who they thought he was going to be. He was not this political Messiah that was going to change their political reality. And he died. And with him, with that death, all of their hopes, their imagined future for what future with Jesus was going to look like, that also died. What deep disappointment the disciples must have been feeling in those 3 days. Perhaps through this Easter season, you've had a chance to reflect on some of your disappointments with God. Maybe you're walking through that right now, or maybe you've walked through that in the past and you remember what that felt like. Perhaps you can identify with the disciples or even with Jesus when he cried out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Where are you in this? Why haven't things turned out the way that I hoped they would or the way that I trusted they would? But then, of course, because we've been following along the story, we know the biggest surprise in the history of the universe happened. Jesus rose from the dead. And no one saw that coming. That was a surprise. It was a huge surprise. He rose from the dead. And so if we're doing a good job in our liturgical calendar of imagining ourselves in this story, we're in that place with the disciples where our faith has really been rocked. And we are needing a new song. So what does a new song look like, and how do you get one? How do you get a new song? I'm a recovering perfectionist. And so when I read things like, sing a new song to the Lord in the Bible, I'm like, all right, I will sing a new song. How do I do that? Let's find the steps, let's sing it, and let's go. But new songs don't work that way. They don't. A couple of years ago, Beyoncé came out with an album titled Lemonade. Now, I have to do a disclaimer here. I never thought I would use Beyoncé as a sermon illustration. And this album should definitely be listened to with parents. And there are some songs on the album that should not be listened to with young ears at all, not yet. But I find I can't help but using this example because it is a good one, and it's in our world. So Beyoncé, on this album, took the approach where she tells a story with all the songs, so you got to listen to them in order. And the story is of her husband's unfaithfulness. And as the songs unfold on the album, you go through her denial, and you go through her grief, and then her anger. Those are the songs that should not be listened to by young ears. And then you go through her sadness. And eventually, as you get towards the end of the album, the songs start to shift a little bit. They change. And you begin to hear lyrics about her experiencing grace and experiencing forgiveness, and then that begins to shift to her ability to offer grace and offer forgiveness. And the album ends, spoiler, the album ends with telling the story of her reconciliation with her husband and how they are trying to make it work and enact forgiveness. Now, when you listen to from start to finish, it makes sense. But if you just picked up one of those songs, so and we do, sometimes you hear one or two of those songs on the radio, you would hear them in a different way. But if you listen from start to finish and you go through the grief and the sadness and the frustration, the disorientation, when you get to that new song, her new song where she's starting to see things in a new light, it's powerful. It's a lot more powerful. Often we pick a psalm out of the Old Testament. If we're feeling low, and I've done this many times, and it's not necessarily bad, but we pick a psalm out that's joyful, and we slap it on ourselves, or we slap it on someone else who's going through, and we're like, God, don't worry. He is victorious. He is good. He is going to be the king of the world. We're going to make it through. But in the Bible, these songs of praise, like we read this morning, they are always in response to a very hard thing or a hard time that Israel was going through. When the Israelites were low, they weren't singing Psalm 98, praise the Lord for he is victorious. They were lamenting, singing songs of lament like Beyoncé or Beyoncé like Israel, whichever way you want to do that. They cried out to God. They challenged him, said, God, why are you silent right now? They wondered why he wasn't acting and why he was hiding from them. When Jesus died, the disciples were not singing Psalm 98. They were crying out with psalms like Psalm 69, save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. And Psalm 109, my God, whom I praise, do not remain silent in this time. Those are the two psalms that Peter quotes in the first chapter of Acts when they're in this dilemma of what do they do about the blank space that's left by Judas, their friend, who betrayed them all. Those two. They were angry and they were grieving and they were processing all of this disorientation. But then Jesus rose from the dead. And things started to shift. And he gradually, as he appeared to them and they processed these things, he poured out his spirit on them on the day of Pentecost, which we're going to visit in a couple weeks. Their lament turned into these new songs of praise. The early church quickly took on this Psalm 98, which is why we are, why it's in the lectionary for today, as a post-Easter song. It was their new song, their reframing of everything. Now that Jesus has risen from the dead, now that he's pouring out his Spirit on us, everything has changed. It was their new song. New songs are happy, joyful songs, but they emerge out of times of disappointment and often despair. You can't force a new song. A renewed vision of God and his faithfulness is a gift that emerges out of our times where we're disoriented and confused about who God is. So, and they come from his surprising action in those times. When he acts in our lives, it's not the way that we expected. And nonetheless, it is his action. So how do you get a new song? How do you sing one if we're told to, if we want to? Well, it sounds counterintuitive, but you own your seasons of grief and disappointment with God. You own them. And even your anger and your cursing, instead of just stewing in it, you direct it to God, which sounds scary and sounds like not what we're supposed to do as Christians. But we actually are supposed to take this, these seasons of, God, where are you and what are you doing, and direct them right at him. And if we do, the wild thing that happens is a new song begins to emerge. Because when we've done that, when we direct it at him, we actually invite him into it. We invite him to speak back to us. We invite him to answer our challenge and our questions. And we invite him to start this new melody in us that actually will reframe our own imagination for the future and for who he is. None of us are born into the faith or into this world with a big enough picture of who God is and what he is up to in the world. And so this, as Christians, is actually an ongoing thing for us. These seasons of disorientation and disappointment with God, and this, if we direct that to him, then this new song that begins to emerge, that eventually becomes our new normal. And we stand on it, and sometimes we forget even that this was at one point a new song for us. And then inevitably we will find ourselves in that place of disorientation, and we keep going until the picture that God creates, this new song he is building in us, gets bigger and bigger and bigger until the day when we will see clearly who he is. So if you are in that place of disappointment or confusion, or you have some challenges for God, direct them to him. And maybe your prayer is simply, God, I need a new vision. I need a clearer picture. Create a new song in me. Next question, what does a new song look like? And here's where we turn really specifically to Psalm 98. A new song is just, it's bigger. In general, it's bigger than the one that you had before. First, it gives us a bigger picture of who God is, a bigger vision of who God is. The first version of this psalm that we read this morning, the one that sort of was like the base psalm for this, was sung by the Israelites on the shore of the Red Sea, after God had rescued them from the armies of Pharaoh. And so for years, as we know the story, we've heard it many times, Israel lived as slaves. They were oppressed and as foreigners in a land that they knew was not their home. And the God of their ancestors, of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, seemed eerily quiet and depressingly absent as they endured this suffering over years, over generations. He was not acting in the way that they hoped he would or knew that he could. But of course, as we know from what happens, they had no idea how God could act and what he could do. And when God intervened, he acted in a show of power over the gods and government of Egypt that was beyond their wildest expectations. It shattered their categories. And now they stood on the edge of this raging sea after a dramatic escape from Egypt. And the water had parted for them, and they had walked across on dry land. That has never happened to me before. I don't know if it's happened to you, but if it did, my categories would be a little bit shattered. I'd suddenly, even though I know this story, the water parted, and they got through, and their enemies were wiped away, and they were safe. They needed a new song. The old songs were no longer adequate. They were not going to do for this kind of action, for this powerful God that they had now experienced. And so Exodus 15, which records the first version of this song, says, "I will sing to the Lord." And it goes on to say, "He has become my salvation. He has revealed himself to me as a God who saves." And Psalm 98, building on this psalm that we first have in Exodus 15, says the same thing in the first three verses in that first section. Why are we singing a new song to the Lord? Because he has made his salvation known. He has revealed himself as the God who is good after all. He is the God who saves and the God who actually is faithful, even though we were really questioning it for a while. He is the God who defies our narrow imagination for who he could be and what he could do. How has God surprised you lately? Maybe you want to recall in your mind a time when God really did surprise you. And he acted in a way that maybe you knew somewhere that he could, but you weren't actually expecting him to act in that way. Where has God made you feel uncomfortable before? Or where are you currently feeling uncomfortable in your faith? Often, that is a sign of God starting to stretch a category that's just not big enough for who he is. Often. Sometimes we need to pay attention to our discomfort from those areas that feel unsettled in our faith, which we always try and make settled. But often, that's God coming, making a new song in us. A new song gives us a bigger vision for who God is. It also gives us a bigger vision for what God is up to in the world, for God's mission. While I was at Regent, I had a friend who was a nurse, and she worked in a very controversial site called InSight. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. It was in Vancouver's downtown east side, where there's tremendous issues of homelessness and drug use and addiction. And so InSight was set up as a place where drug users could actually come and safely inject and safely use. And the idea was not to promote drug use, but actually to provide to a place where lives could be saved and where relationships could be built of trust, where people could actually be helped out of addiction and out of that system. But as you can imagine, and as maybe you're feeling right now as you think about this, it was pretty controversial. And especially in the church. And my friend Mira is a Christian, and she felt called to work in this place. And she wrote an article that actually won a national award a few years ago, and I want to read an excerpt from it, because I was also challenged by this. And I remember sitting in class in some of our discussions and thinking, but as Christians, should we be helping people do something that we know is it leads to death? How does this work? And then I read Mira's article. Another regular chats with me, a regular as in a regular attendee, in the treatment room as I dress his abscess, trying not to cringe away from the overwhelming odor he emanates. It would have been my anniversary with my wife today if she hadn't gone missing. We've both been down and out, but she took care of me out here, and now I got no one to talk to. This is the first human touch I've had today. I look up, startled. I'm wearing gloves, holding my breath, cleaning his sores with a 10-inch sterile Q-tip. And even this, my deficient attempt to heal, is taken as love by a man desperate for human connection. I'm ashamed. I finish dressing the wound, clean up, remove my gloves, and give him a hug. I hop up on the treatment bench next to him, and we sit together and talk for another 15 minutes about life, love, and faith. He says goodbye and asks for a referral to an exit program. It's a program to get off of drugs. I give it to him, and he knows the referral is merely one point along our journey together, and that I will listen to his story, whether he goes to the program or not. As a Christian, I know that his life is part of God's real story of redemption, and insight is one of the few places where I get to hear it openly spoken with trust and without judgment. Through Mira's stories of working in this place, of being able to offer human touch to someone who would not otherwise have any contact with another human being, her ability to sit with people in the midst of their pain, regardless of whether they were going to be able to change or not, I learned that God's mission, what God is up to in this world, is bigger than the categories that I had created for it. New songs give us a bigger vision for God's mission in the world. Psalm 98 speaks of a day when God will rule the whole earth as a just king. And he will be just. He will enact justice for every person from every single background, breaking down all of our categories and the barriers that we have set up. It's a really bold psalm, especially if you read, and I'm talking now about the middle chunk of it. If you read those verses, it talks about God in this universal sense of God wrapping his arms around the whole world and bringing them into himself. Verse 4 calls the whole earth to make a joyful noise unto the Lord, not just Israel. The instruments and culture of every nation are called to participate in this wild party. And that's what it is. It's a wild, colorful party. The last verse of Psalm 98 gives the reason for the party. The reason for this loud celebration is, let them sing before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. Doesn't exactly sound like a great reason for a party. He will judge, but here's the kind of judge he is. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples with equity. Every person under God's rule can expect justice, can expect fair treatment and love, regardless of who they are or where they have come from. Does anyone know what yesterday was, what the celebration yesterday was? Yes. Cinco de Mayo. What are some of the things that pop into your head when you hear about that festival, Cinco de Mayo? I think tacos. Piñatas. Festivals, parties, colorful, beautiful. Mexico. It's not actually Mexico's Independence Day celebration, but it celebrates a battle that Mexico won. It was a victory over France, a colonial power that was trying to recolonize them in a moment of weakness. And Mexico won. And it's actually not widely celebrated in Mexico, funny enough. It's mostly celebrated in the United States. And it became a popular festival in the 1960s when a lot of Mexican Americans joined the civil rights movement because they were fighting against racism. And so this became a celebration of victory over oppression. It was this symbol, this sort of bold symbol of celebrating and partying, and in that act, pushing against the darkness of racism in the states at that time. The festivities have changed a little bit since those original days, but those are the roots of it. Psalm 98 envisions a day when the whole world is going to join together in that kind of a celebration. And it's going to be loud, and it will be crazy, and it might involve tacos. I hope it involves tacos. But according to Scripture, it's going to be bright and colorful. It's going to be diverse in its expression, because God will be king of the whole earth, of every nation. And not only that, and this is a whole other sermon, which I was tempted to preach, but don't worry, I've just cut it down to this small bit. But the whole of creation is part of this celebration. And so if you look at the last chunk of Psalm 98. It says that the rivers are going to clap their hands and the mountains singing for joy. Creation itself is rejoicing. Why? Because God's redemption and restoration not only includes the humans in this world, but includes the creation that he made and called good. And so I imagine the prophets, maybe modern day prophets, saying the words, you know, in that day he will wipe every tear from your eye and pluck every piece of plastic from your waters. Because that's the kind of restoration that God is up to. It's a big, big mission. A new song gives us a bigger vision of what God is up to in the world. So we're going to sing a new song together today, and not actually singing a song. Again, I'm speaking metaphorically here. But communion, participating in communion, is actually partially an act of singing a new song. When we take communion, we're symbolizing having a meal together, right? We have bread and we have wine, or juice in our case. And we are remembering the last meal that Jesus had with his disciples. When he, right before he died, when he told them that his death would actually become life to them, just like bread and juice are the staples of our diet and become life to us. Jesus' death would be like that for them. But we're also, when we're taking communion, remembering or symbolizing another meal. And this is one that we don't talk about as often. The early church also practiced communion as a symbolic future meal, one that's going to happen. And this is the great feast that we read about in Revelation, the Supper of the Lamb. A feast that will take place when Jesus comes to rule the world. Every nation will be there in justice and in peace. Every single culture represented. It's sort of like the Cinco de Mayo celebration I was talking about earlier in a feast. And when we take communion, we actually declare our hope for that time when we will come together in this beautiful, diverse, and colorful new song about God's rule on earth. It will be joyful, abundant, will probably be wild, and it will be a celebration of God's justice and his love. And a celebration that's only made possible through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It turns out that this new song that we're singing is not so much a new song as though we just came up with it and no one has ever heard it before. It's actually an ancient song. It's a song that was sung over creation when God created the world. And he is letting us in on it as we go, expanding our limited songs and making them bigger and bigger.